Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item. Current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Mars, the planet that we all gaze at when we see it turn red, sometimes bright red, depending upon the Martian dust storms. The fact that we gaze upon it is a way of connecting us to our ancients, our progenitors, the people who first gazed on Mars without our instruments and robots and success. Someone who tells this story wonderfully, I welcome Matthew Schindel. He is a space history curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, and his new book is For the Love of Mars, A Human History of the Red Planet. The ancients did not shy away from interpreting Mars, so Matt, congratulations and good evening. We go immediately to the Mayans, who looked upon Mars as a zoomorph. A Mars beast. What did they make of that red planet in the sky? Good evening to you.
Thank you, John. So, you know, the story of the Mayans is very interesting. I was attracted to that story partly because, you know, the Mayans have this incredibly, you know, robust understanding of cosmology, of, you know, the role that the planets played in their world. And, you know, I really wanted to learn a little bit more while I was writing this book about how they saw Mars and what it meant to them. And in reading a lot of the anthropological literature about that relationship between the Mayans and the sky, I did find archaeologists who were making this argument that in this one particular codex, the Dresden Codex, there was a table related to the motions of Mars. And in that table, they found depictions of what they ended up calling the Mars Beast. So I want to be clear, it's not the Mayans that called it the Mars Beast. It's these particular archaeologists who, you know, their argument is that what you see in that codex, in those pages where the Mars Beast appears, is the beast coming down from the sky, making itself more visible, and then going back up. And what they argued is that what you're seeing there is Mars during an opposition. That's when the Earth, Mars, and Sun are lined up, and Mars is in its closest position to the Earth in its orbit. And it becomes larger and brighter in the sky just as the Earth is passing it in our orbit. And, you know, we start to see Mars appear to change direction in the sky because of our relative motions as we are passing it, because we move faster in our orbit than Mars does. And so what they were arguing is this is Mars coming into opposition and then going into what astronomers call retrograde motion, that seeming change in direction before it starts going the normal direction again. So, so the Mars beast may have been a depiction of what was happening in the sky. And again, according to these archaeologists, looking in the Dresden Codex, what they believe they're seeing is a connection between that occurrence, which happens about every couple of years, and a change in the tropical growing seasons.
We look at the Chinese version of Mars, gazing on Mars. This is the Qin Dynasty, and before that, the Han Dynasty. And they were looking for the patterns of heavens. As with the Mayans, the color red is important. You can see it without a telescope that it's red. However, the Chinese had a well-developed understanding. Again, I don't want to say, I don't want to use English language, but it appears mm-hmm. that they're projecting human emotions onto Mars. Is that a fair generalization of what the Mayans and the Chinese are doing?
Well, they were definitely, if you want to sort of think about it this way, anthropomorphizing them, right? They were giving the planets a certain amount of agency. They were making them participants in their world. they were giving them a role in communicating, from the celestial or heavenly part of the world down to Earth. So, yeah, they were at once part of the natural world, but also sort of related to something more divine in their ability to either, reenact important events of the gods or to communicate from the gods down to, the people on Earth. And for the ancient Chinese in the Han and Qing dynasty, they had sort of inherited from thousands of years of observing the sky before written records, this idea that a good ruler found harmony with the sky, with the earth, with events in both places, and was able to achieve that harmony and achieve peace, and that the heavens and what was happening in the heavens were at the same time sort of warnings about problems to come, but also signs that things were in alignment. So you were always looking to see that, that the rule was legitimate, that the ruler himself was making the right choices. And so, this was one way in which Chinese society was able to hold leaders accountable, was through astronomy and astrology. And it was one of the main reasons why, both in the case of the Maya and in the Chinese case, why kings and emperors supported financially astronomy and astrology and created this class of educated astronomers and astrologers, essentially priests, who would study the sky closely and look for signs of trouble or of harmony.
Not just war, but the Chinese found robbery, sickness, mourning, famine, warfare. Let's go immediately to the Mesopotamians, who see omens. And I write down one sentence you provided for us. In the belief of omens lies the birth of science. That's very poetic, Matt.
Yeah, well, I can't take credit for it. That was another historian of science, Noel Swerdlow, said that. And what he was saying was that, the Babylonians supported an incredibly large sort of army of astronomer astrologers, who watched the sky very vigilantly and recorded not only everything they saw, but also everything that was happening around them when they saw that thing happen, so that they could build a catalog of what types of events on Earth went along with different events happening in the sky. And they also developed mathematical tools that allowed them to not necessarily describe the structure of the heavens, but predict where the planets would be on different nights. And that's what Swerdlow was saying, is that by looking so closely for those omens and keeping such detailed records and developing those mathematical tools, they essentially started acting like what we associate with science today, at least in terms of their development of mathematical tools. Culturally, of course, they were looking for something very different from what we are looking for when we look at the sky today. But in the terms of the sort of the thought process and the tools that they developed, Swerdlow was saying that they were essentially inventing science in that moment.
Plato, yes, sees the heavens and believes it's a reason for education. His student Aristotle divides everything that is. These are not physical worlds to them. They're part of everything in the world. Into earth, water, air, and fire, and plus ether. Everything swims or exists in the ether. But Ptolemy's most important. You emphasize that he worked at the library in Alexandria. And Ptolemy comes up with a way of picturing the planets especially, but he can't solve it. He can't solve what they're observing naturally. And the Greeks now introduce, or the Greek world introduce, the next 2,000 years to whether the Earth is at the center of all of this and the planets and the sun and the stars are moving around us, or whether something else is at the center. And Matt, where is Mars in this debate? Just one of the planets that they're observing, and they're not sure whether it's circling Earth or whether Earth and Mars are circling something else.
Well, for Aristotle, he was pretty certain that Mars was was circling the Earth. Because when he looked at the world, what he saw was, you know, a physics that seemed specific to the world beneath the moon, right? He saw his four main elements, earth, water, air, and fire. He saw how they interacted with each other, and he saw that the general trend was for things to move either up or down in the sublunar world. And then when he looked at the heavens, everything from the moon and outward, all he saw was circular motion. And so he thought, you know, there must be something different about the heavens versus everything that's below the moon. It must, there must be a special physics up there that prefers perfect circular motion. And so that's why he invented that fifth element, the ether, which had just different properties, different qualities that allowed it to behave differently from those four earthly or sublunar elements. And so once you've kind of adopted that structure and that physics for how things move, then, you know, it's very difficult to imagine a universe in which the Earth is orbiting the sun, since the Earth is made of these heavy elements and everything's moving up and down. And the heavens, on the other hand, are made of this special element that only moves in circles. And so, you know, it was very difficult for folks who adopted that Aristotelian model to then imagine anything other than an Earth-centered universe. And so that was Ptolemy. You know, Ptolemy was living well after Aristotle in the Roman Empire. He was, as you said, living in Alexandria, where he had access to all kinds of materials at the library and museum in Alexandria. And he started pulling together all of this ancient storehouse of knowledge into the book that he wrote that, you know, folks later in the medieval period would call the Almagest. It was a name given to the that book by Islamic scholars. It essentially meant the greatest, that this is the greatest book ever written about astronomy. And, you know, it was that book, the Almagest, and also another work of Ptolemy's called the Tetrabiblos, these four books about astrology, that came to define that medieval worldview for the Islamic world and then also for Christian Europe, giving them not only this structured heavens of these nested spheres with all of the planets, including Mars, you know, moving in perfect circles, but also this knowledge about the significance of that, of what it meant when Mars or any other planet was in a different part of the sky or behaving in certain ways. And yeah, there were things that Ptolemy couldn't really explain very well, like that change in appearance of Mars or the retrograde motion of Mars. And Mars kind of sticks out like a sore thumb for a lot of medieval astronomers after Ptolemy, who were trying to apply this rule of perfect circular motion to the heavens, because Mars just, you know, in many ways doesn't want to behave in that Earth-centered model.
Let's go to the medieval world. The book is For the Love of Mars. Matthew Schindel is the author. A Human History of the Red Planet. I'm John Batchelor.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.